Hello and welcome to Growth Coaching International's Coaching in Education podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reid, and today we're diving into a fascinating discussion about leadership, coaching and professional development in education. My guest today is Dr. Chris Baker. Chris leads professional development for a large group of schools in the southwest of England, supporting over 3,000 staff. He also delivers and assesses the National Professional Qualification for Senior Leadership and works with a range of organisations on leadership development. Chris is the author of Leadership Launchpads, a visually engaging book packed with 100 powerful leadership concepts, covering everything from public narratives to sludge audits. But what really stands out about Chris is his journey from what he describes as a dire early education to an obsession with professional learning and coaching. In this episode, we explore his story, his coaching philosophy, and why he believes that not everyone needs to be a coach, yet coaching as a way of leading is essential. In addition to that, we unpack the why of coaching in schools and the importance of partnership, enabling conditions, and a coaching stance in leadership. So, whether you're a school leader, coach, or educator looking to enhance your conversations and leadership approach, you won't want to miss this episode. Chris, I'm delighted you're able to join me on the podcast today.
Oh man, I am so excited about this. Huge fan of yours, huge fan, obviously, of growth coaching. And yeah, just a pleasure to be able to come on and maybe share some of the, the learning that I've done.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it. We're off to a good start, Chris. A lovely positive start. Chris, on your Leadership Launchpad site, you use the phrase, after a pretty dire early education, I have become obsessed with my own professional learning and finding ways to leverage that to help others. And I'd love just to break that up into three distinct elements and ask a question each. So firstly, can you share with us your experiences in education in those early years and maybe unpack a little for us around that dire aspect?
Yeah, I hope none of my previous teachers are listening to this. I was a pretty kind of invisible child, really, at school. I wasn't smart, so I wasn't on anyone's radar, but I wasn't badly behaved, so I wasn't on anyone's radar either. I just kind of floated seemingly through school. And I had, what I didn't know at the time was I had really low aspirations, which is interesting because I thought I was popular and I was sporty and all those things. But what I didn't realize was that because I didn't really have a high expectation of what I was going to do with my life, I then had low engagement with the whole schooling process. And I took very, very few risks. And so I kind of scraped through every stage, really. I kind of got enough, what we call GCSEs to get to the next stage, and then it got just enough to get to university. And even, even at university, I did the bare minimum. And again, just scraped that. That was the early years.
I think that being able to look back over those years in a very open and honest way, I think, is a very encouraging thing, Chris, to be honest with you. And I think our listeners will appreciate that. Sometimes we put out these podcast episodes with absolute perfection. And I don't think people overly appreciate that. People like to know, what's the nitty-gritty? What were the mistakes? And essentially, how did you get around that? And I think that sort of a story, which is real life, is the sort of thing that just lands with people really well. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And that's really moving me on to the second part of that question. So tell us about, you've turned everything around. Tell us about your obsession with your own professional learning. What have you studied? What things did you do to turn from dire to obsessed?
Exactly. Take me out. One of the really fascinating things was, I don't think, I'm sure I had these experiences, but they weren't strong enough experiences to be burned into my mind. That idea of you learn something and then you're better afterwards, and then you link the improvement with the learning, which makes you then go and seek out more learning. And this sounds like some sort of Hollywood script, but I went traveling, in my 20s after like a summer camp in America. And I went to all kinds of crazy places. And I ended up finding two books, really. I found one in the Bolivian jungle, which was crazy, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm sure lots of listeners have read that, Stephen Covey. But the other one I found, which was really fascinating, I found Under a Mattress in Sydney. So there's an Australia link there. And those, whether it was the right time of my life or what, but reading those books kind of gave me some almost like life strategies, which I then, for whatever reason, implemented and then instantly saw the benefit and thought, hang on a minute, this is a pretty straightforward equation here. Learn, try, improve, learn, try, improve. And that was it, really. I came back from traveling a completely different person, as you can imagine. Someone who was previously really low in kind of confidence. And then, you know, you do that many years of traveling and on your own and you can't come back not, you know, with some confidence. And so then I was looking for more challenges. I tried some physical stuff, which I found reasonably straightforward. But it was always the academics, as I said before, that I shied away from when I was younger because it was too risky. And I ended up doing a master's degree because in the school I was working at, they paid for it. And so it felt like, I think one of my other friends was doing it. And so I sort of tagged onto that. And it wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be, and learnt loads, and then was able to use that learning in my teaching. And again, that idea of instantly seeing the benefit. And so that was it. And I was off then. I did the master's and then I was like, right, what's next? What's next? And someone said, oh, well, you know, you could go and try and do a doctorate if you wanted. And I thought, well, you know, let's give it a try. And that was not without its challenges. And in a really weird kind of meta way, I did my doctorate on leadership confidence whilst being a leader with low confidence. So I was kind of learning about the thing that I was unconfident in and getting more confident as I learned about it. So I ended up doing a doctorate in leadership self-efficacy is the actual title. And I've been thirsty ever since. So I've done my kind of ILM7 in executive coaching, a few other little things. And so I talk to people about this thing called a self-efficacy spiral. Mm-hmm. This idea that, you know, confidence typically improves performance. And of course, improved performance builds confidence and so on and so on. And so I've been on what I would now call a self-efficacy upward spiral for a long time. And the more I learn, the more I see the benefit. And so the more effort I put in and the more effort I put in, you know, the more I learn. So, yeah, exciting times.
It really is. And that's a lovely journey you've been on, because I'd written down here, you mentioned in those early days, so going way back into school days, you talked about taking very few risks. So obviously that was something which probably led, in your words, to low confidence in many ways. But once you got to the point where you were brave enough to take a few risks in the learning side of things, you realize that, and just to use your lovely little phrase there, that circle, you know, learning and then implementing what you've learned, what you've read, particularly those two books that you started with, then eventually led to improvement. And then you're repeating the cycle, learning again, implementing, and more improvement. And that's where, again, to use your words, the confidence started to grow. And ironically, and I mean, that's, you certainly were biting off a significant amount, you know, for a PhD, but actually studying leadership confidence, you know, and developing your confidence as you go along. So that idea of self-efficacy, you know, the upwards spiral, that's a lovely way of describing that, which is essentially, or should be, an ongoing thing. So it's a lovely way of, you know, just mapping out that time, which in many ways, you know, brings us up to probably more recent times. So if you think about where you are now, and this is sort of the third element of this first question, can you give us a bit of an overview then of, you know, how do you currently then help others? You know, what's a typical day or week look like for Chris at the moment?
Yeah, well, like you said at the beginning, so I work across 35 schools in a kind of a trust of a group of schools, and I work in their kind of school improvement team with a lens of teaching and learning and professional development. And so my week is very varied, which is great. I mean, it runs from sort of challenging quality assurance meetings with leaders of T&L and PD to T&L and PD design meetings with leaders. So you've got the QA and you've got the design. I then do a lot of coaching, as you can imagine. So coaching with teachers, coaching with the leaders. I do a bit of, you know, supervision, so a bit of coaching. And so, yeah, my week is usually split between those activities.
I like the fact you mentioned varied. You know, I can relate to that idea of having such a variety. And again, drawing on a lot of what you've learned over that period of time. Interesting, the conversations you're having, because you actually categorize them there. There are some there that are challenging, and those are, you know, a very, very unique type of conversation. Some in there around design, which is obviously, you know, very useful as well within the education setting. Coaching conversations, again, with a variety of different people. And then I suppose that element of supervision comes in as well. So let's dive a wee bit more deeply into your coaching work. And again, just referring back to your website, you have a coaching model there, which in many ways sets out your approach to coaching. And in it, you mention the word partnership, which, as you know, with us here at Growth Coaching International and the Instructional Coaching Group, it's a vital part of our approach to coaching. In your experience, why is partnership so key to a successful coaching conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think any kind of hierarchical environment, or any time you've kind of got a lack of humility, I just think that erodes loads of the kind of fundamental conditions that are required for effective coaching conversations. And I think it goes deeper than that, though, because I think you can potentially fool yourself that you've been successful in a coaching conversation without partnership. But I think you're very quickly undone by the two bits that come after that, the lack of action and the lack of sustainable change. So I think there's three things there. There's kind of, it's vitally important to the conversation, but potentially even more important to the action that comes after it, and then the sustained change that hopefully that coachee makes.
I love the way you put that, because you've set that out very, very clearly that, yes, first of all, it's very much about cutting through the hierarchy. Okay, so, you know, setting out your stall, I suppose, in many ways for the coachee, for the person that you're talking to, which is really important. So it's useful during the conversation, but it's interesting the way you phrase that. You know, sometimes you can kid yourself that this has been a good and I'm smiling because I can relate to this, Chris, myself and my own experience as a coach. You think you've had a good conversation, but the evidence there where there hasn't been partnership is ultimately the lack of action as a result of the conversation. I think that's a very, very clear way of putting that. And equally important is that idea there isn't sustainable change. So I think that's really useful for folks who are listening and they're implementing coaching in their particular setting. There may well be just good conversations going on, but when you really look at it and you analyse the conversation, you're asking yourself, how much is partnership actually playing, you know, a core part of what we're doing here? Because essentially, if I look beyond the conversation, is there going to be good quality action, things that are being implemented, and ultimately, is it sustainable? Because for folks who are listening, particularly school leaders, they want to implement something into the school that's going to affect change, but sustainable change. So it's not just a token gesture. I think that's very helpful.
Well, I think it's interesting if we go back to the conversations thing, because I think the partnership, most people think of when there's not partnership, there's only a negative impact on the coachee. But actually, I think if as a coach, you don't see it as a partnership, that's also a bit of a problem, because that might lead you to the two extremes of maybe overly passive, because you don't think you've got a voice, or overly directive in that you think they don't have a voice. But also, and I'm sure you're the same, I mean, that whole reciprocity thing, like, I don't remember the last coaching conversation I had that I didn't learn something myself. You know? And so I go into this thing, and I love it when people are like, thankful and praiseworthy. I say, hey, this is just as much of a joy for me as it is for you, do you know? And so I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a useful way of looking at it, Chris, when we think about partnership, not just thinking about the coachee, the other person, but thinking about the coach.
Yeah.
So it's going to be useful again for our listeners, because you're right, you know, reciprocity plays a big part in coaching done well. You know, in many ways, like you say, you go through a conversation and as the coach, you're learning something new, not even necessarily about the other person, but sometimes about yourself.
Yeah. There's a bit of research by a pair of researchers called McBroom and Reed, and they, you know, this whole like knowing doing gap, do you know, like, yes, you can learn something, but actually doing it's a different story. They use this phrase to categorize people as inclined abstainers. So these are the people that nod and smile and say, yeah, oh, that's so great. Oh, that's amazing. Great, great, great. And then they don't do anything about it. So they are they have every inclination to do it, but something is wrong. And I think that's potentially because of what I would say is almost like an abdicated accountability when they don't feel like a partner. It's almost like they've said, that's great, but I'm not responsible or accountable for this.
Yeah, and that's useful too for listeners. We're thinking about people who are maybe at the stage where they've started to, you know, introduce coaching, there could well be, let's be honest, a percentage of your team who are inclined abstainers. There's a lot of smiling, a lot of nodding, but ultimately paying lip service to the conversation, you know, which again is a useful way of looking at it, Chris. That's going to be very helpful for folks who are listening in. Because you make it clear again in your coaching approach that enabling conditions are a vital part of the coaching relationship. I wonder maybe could you share with us, you know, what do you mean by enabling conditions in your experience?
Yeah, so we, you know, I think it's not enough to want coaching in your organization. You know, you also have to be ready. I mean, as I said, I work with, you know, 35 schools, and, you know, a lot of them buy into the concept of coaching. They've potentially seen the impact of it externally, so they want a piece of that. And so I get lots of people coming to me saying, right, Chris, we want to put coaching across the school. And I, at the beginning, I was very much accommodating of that, but it dawned on me that actually, and there's a set of potentially enabling kind of organizational factors that have to be kind of in place because they underpin the kind of successful implementation. So a bit like that conversation, you might think that it's going well and you implemented it, but if those foundational things aren't in place, you're in trouble. So one of the things that we talk about when people come to me, I talk about doing like a readiness review. And so it's a fairly tricky conversation because we talk about, you know, have you got the right culture? You know, so do you have across the organization high levels of psychological safety? Do you have high levels of kind of strong personal ownership of PD? And does everybody at all levels believe in the power of coaching? So there's a cultural element. We don't shy away from some of the less kind of sexy stuff around capacity. Do you know, like, do you have enough capacity to train these people, to supervise them, and to protect time for the coaching to happen? Because you try squeezing this in, and I think you're on a slippery slope there. So that leads into the commitment side of things. And then also a bit of clarity. You know, is everybody clear on what excellence looks like? Because that's a challenge. If people are talking, if there's not a kind of shared language about what excellent teaching and learning or excellent leadership or whatever it is you're trying to improve is, but also, is there a clarity about what effective coaching is, what an effective, you know, conversation looks like, and those things. And so I think that's really interesting because we find that when we've had schools that have rushed into these things and they potentially run the risk of creating what we call it coaching baggage. So this idea that people have a negative experience, which then sits with them and they hold on to that and they carry it with them. And that Yeah, that damages any kind of long-term implementation, I think.
A lot of really useful things in there, Chris. You started off by talking about it's not enough just to want coaching to happen in your school. You need to be ready for it. I like the idea of a readiness review. And again, just to go back to one of your earlier comments, tying in with the fact that that can be a difficult conversation as well. Because ultimately, you're asking hard questions. And I think that's why, I mean, over countless episodes that I've had the privilege of recording for Growth Coaching International on this podcast, again and again and again, start small, you know, get a couple of key people in there who have a shared understanding of what, you know, coaching done well looks like, and essentially build it up from there. We have a strap line which we use, you know, we talk about theory and good intentions meet reality. And that is there for a reason, because again, there's lots of nice new shiny objects out there in schools, and we can grab at them with the best of intentions. But to bring in your comment of, you know, a readiness review, are we ready for this to do it well? And I love that phrase, coaching baggage. I can just picture a little graphic that you would use maybe in one of your books to sort of, you know, explain what coaching baggage is. But it's true. You know, some people come in some cases to the coaching conversation with coaching baggage from elsewhere, maybe in another school, and that can be a negative thing, or it can develop at the start in a school if it's just not implemented properly. If I'm picking that up properly.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly that, really. I think for me, most of it does come from previous coaching experiences, which does make me worry about where we are at the moment. We maybe come onto this later about, are we unwittingly creating baggage by not really kind of thinking deeply enough about how this has been implemented? But again, similarly to what we talked about before, I don't think that it's just the coachee that brings baggage with them. I think as coaches, potentially we have got a potentially fixed mindset about people, or a fixed mindset about coaching, or maybe a fixed approach. I remember when I first started doing executive coaching, I was obsessed with models, you know, coaching models, you know, and I found one that seemed to make sense to me. And so that was it. I was, you know, right, good. I haven't got to think about that anymore. And, you know, over time you think, well, hold on, that's not what it's all about. And so, yeah, I think in the contracting that I do with my coaches, we talk a lot about baggage and, you know, if you've got any and that sort of thing. And yeah, luckily, yeah, not as much as they could be there. So that's good.
Chris, in our planning discussion prior to recording this, one of the things that you mentioned, and genuinely it caught my attention, was a statement that just in conversation, you know, not everyone needs to be a coach. And I mean, we're thinking about bringing this into a whole school culture. And yes, not everyone needs to be a coach. I think it'd be really helpful for listeners if we could maybe unpack that a little bit, particularly school leaders who are maybe thinking about introducing coaching in their settings. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, to talk quite vulnerably about my, you know, potentially fixed mindset when I first started doing executive coaching around, you know, seeing coaching just as a formal activity, because I think we can't get away from the fact that we have limited capacity in schools, both financial, time, people, all that stuff. And so if you want to implement coaching on a wide scale in your school, you're going to bump up against those capacity issues. And I guess the worst thing you can do is to dilute the coaching because of that. And so we started kind of thinking, okay, we've got aspirations that every member of staff in a school, in a trust, benefits from coaching. So if we do that, we've got to think of it slightly differently. So we tend to think of it almost like three dimensions. So we think of coaching as a culture. So we try to make sure that all of our policy systems, you know, all those things are coach-like. We think of it as a formal activity, fine, yeah, which some people will be trained in and some people will engage in. But the real kind of, I guess, win or push that we've had recently is seeing it as just an approach to conversation. So coaching as an approach to conversation. And so we've been kind of exploring that, really, this idea that anybody from you know, our kind of caretaker, to our receptionist, to our teacher, to our middle leader, to our CEO, can just take a coaching approach to their line management, their feedback, or even just their corridor conversations. And it's really gone down super well because people, you can see people start to relax a little bit when they say, oh, so I'm not going to be a formal coach. And you say, oh, no. And better than that, you're probably doing a lot of this stuff already. So that's gone down an absolute storm with people in my trust, yeah.
I think that's helpful as well, Chris, because I mean, there's no school that's going to go out there that's going to implement this, as you say, right across every member of staff or everybody's having formal coaching conversation. As a former head myself, there simply isn't enough time on the timetable. So we would be kidding ourselves to even think about trying that out. But essentially, you used the phrase that we're going to bring coaching into our school. We're going to develop a coaching culture so that everyone benefits from coaching. And that can be benefiting from it in different ways. For some people, it might be me sitting down having a formal coaching conversation that we've timetabled. That's great. But for everybody, that's not always going to be the case. So there is opportunity through, again, shared language, you know, some effective training where essentially everybody can come at conversations with a coaching approach to it. And ultimately then, we're achieving the goal that everybody is benefiting from a coach approach to the conversations. We go back to that phrase again, you know, it's just the way we talk around here. And that takes time, you know, it doesn't happen overnight, but ultimately that's a goal.
Yeah. And I was just laughing then because we do like a 60-minute workshop with all staff, and usually it's like on a, you know, kind of, you know, a big kind of training day. And I almost feel a bit apologetic by the end of it because, you know, usually, and I take it as a compliment, people go, oh, is that it? Like, oh, because we talk about this thing called a coaching crossroads. So this idea that, I don't know, the first coaching crossroad is someone comes to ask you for help, and we call it kind of the TA crossroad. You know, someone comes and asks me for help, I'm either going to tell them or I'm going to ask them. It's as simple as that. I make a decision right there and then whether I'm going to tell or ask. And that puts me, if I go with ask, on a kind of coaching conversation pathway. And we talk about like one of the gateway questions being, oh, tell me more about that. And there's usually then just some hilarious thing that runs through the whole workshop then where I say, what are we going to say first? And in some sort of choral response, they go, tell me more about that. So that made me giggle.
Fantastic. Yes. You do need a sense of humor in the middle of this education business, Chris. It's very, very important. Very, very important. I'm a big advocate for it. Let's crank it up a wee bit to thinking about around leadership. Because again, that's a big part of what you do, Chris, and a lot of what you write about and talk about and train through. You mentioned when we were chatting again, you know, prior to the recording, that our own executive director, Chris Monroe, had caught your attention at one stage with his work on a coaching stance, and again, particularly within the context of leadership. So considering your latest book is called Leadership Launchpads, I'd love to hear your thoughts on coaching as a way of leading.
Yeah. I mean, firstly, when I think about kind of coaching expertise, I definitely, you know, think that, you know, that lies in the coach's ability to responsively meet the needs of their client, if you want to call it that. You know, that's where the real expertise, and not dissimilar to expert teachers, really, you know, their ability to responsively meet the needs of their students is what we would use as a measure of their expertise. I'm a huge fan of these kind of fluid approaches to coaching and mentoring, you know, like Holweck, Downey, Chris, and even Christian's work, you know, all that stuff on kind of really, really listening and kind of seeking to understand, and then like subtly refiguring or shifting your coaching kind of what we would call now stance to meet that need. And I love Chris's idea about this idea that there's two elements to it. It's kind of how you show up, you know, as a kind of coach or as a leader, I suppose, and then what you do as that conversation unfolds. And I love the word unfold because that's really, you know, how these conversations happen, isn't it? You know, you don't really know what's round the corner And so you have to be just really connected, I suppose. And we talked earlier about the variety of my job and the people I, you know, speak to. And I think one of the really interesting things is, as you said, some of those conversations are quite formal. Some of them are informal. Some of them are called coaching. Some of them are not called coaching. But the thread that runs through it is the way I approach each of the conversations, you know? And so I have to use Chris's kind of language, adjust my stance to the person that I'm working with. Because one day I'm working with, an early career teacher, and the next time I'm working with, a senior leader. But it's also, I have to shift the stance between sessions with the same person, because the foci changes, their expertise changes, their confidence changes, the immediacy of it may change. But I think it goes even further, and it links back to that unfolding, that my radar for stance change is always on, even during a conversation, that I'm constantly sort of temperature checking. In teacher language, it's almost assessment for learning, isn't it? You're checking, and you're making tiny little tweaks to where you're going with it. So yeah, huge fan of all that stuff. I was really taken by this idea that leaders and potentially coaches make themselves kind of progressively unnecessary, which is fascinating to me, that I'm not trying to create a dependent relationship. I'm almost trying to be constantly getting out of it. I'm trying to build you so well, you don't need me anymore. I'm lucky I don't get paid to do coaching, because that would probably not be a great financial model. But I think, when I must have read God knows how many books on leadership for the doctorate. And if we were to isolate a goal of leadership being to grow others, I think coaching has to be part of that skill set, and it doesn't have to be, without a formal coaching arrangement. I think that growth happens through conversation. So it almost feels like coaching as a way of leading is kind of like the intentional use of coaching skills to improve the effectiveness of the conversations that you have. I think that feels like, a strong thing. And of course, for me, the beauty of good coaching is the flexibility of it. And I think that's super, super important for leaders, because they lead different types of people. And so similarly to what I just said about my role, any leader needs a tool that has flex in it that they can kind of use with the different people that they lead. And it may be that somebody that they lead just needs space to think, and that's one approach. It may be that, you use a coaching approach to give some fairly tough feedback. It might also be that coaching conversation is just a safe space for them to practice stuff. And also, I said earlier that I'm a big fan of this fluid kind of continuum of skills. Sometimes I find myself, as a leader, using my coaching to guide people. And I don't withhold that expertise. I don't lead with it. But when necessary, I'm not ashamed to or afraid to sort of, add a bit of input myself.
I think a key word, Chris, that you're picking up on there, and you've used it even in various forms, was that idea of responsively meeting the needs of the other person. And that essentially, from a leader's point of view, you're meeting a lot of different people, but even as you say, Chris, even within the one conversation, the needs of that person may change within that one conversation. And that's where, in many ways, because you said that phrase, conversations unfold. There's no predicting where they're going to go. You can plan, to the nth degree, but ultimately, as a leader, that conversation is going to go in directions you might never expect. So having a coach approach to your conversations and a coach approach to your leadership means you're very much, tuning that responsive response that you have. And you used a lovely phrase there, having a radar for stance change. A nice picture. It is a nice picture because, to go back to another phrase you used, you know, good leaders grow other leaders. And, you know, there are times whenever you need to move back and forward across that continuum to help the other person out. Because ultimately what we're doing is we're responsively meeting the needs of the other person, which essentially is what a good leader does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chris, you're based, and I mentioned this at the very start of the episode, you're based in the UK and have a good grasp of the education landscape through the experience you have at the moment. So with the rapid surge, and there has been a rapid surge in interest in coaching and education over fairly recent years, there are various schools of thought about what coaching done well looks like. At GCI, we have a great question. You'll see it on our homepage and the website, coined by our very own Christian van Nieuwburg, which asks, if coaching is the answer, what is the question? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on the why for coaching in schools. You know, what should be motivating school leaders to look at introducing coaching into their setting?
Yeah, that is great, isn't it? Yeah. Well, when I think about that, and I think about kind of maybe questions that I would get asked, for which I would then say coaching, you know, I think if a school leader said to me, how can I provide my staff with truly personalized professional development, I'd say coaching, because there's not, in my mind, there's not a single other form of professional development that comes even close to being able to give an individual what they need when they need it in a way that they need it. There's nothing else that goes close to that. I think if a school leader said to me, maybe something around, how do I support staff to take responsibility for their professional learning, you know, and to continually improve, coaching is the answer there. I think that idea of some of the core, I guess, outcomes of coaching done well is this sort of improved self-awareness, potential critical thinking, and more importantly, self-management. Those are skills that, if they're developed through coaching, will echo beyond the coaching kind of contract. And then linking back to my work as a, you know, a more fundamental coaching approach, I wonder if a school leader said to me, how can I improve the quality and effectiveness of every developmental conversation in my school? Then I'd say, well, you know, that's easy. Coaching is the way forward. You know, if you could invest in every member's staff's ability to kind of take a coaching approach to conversation, I think not only would you improve the outcomes of those conversations, but you'd see massive improvements just in the relationships between people, the levels of agency. And of course, you know, my favorite word, self-efficacy, you know, I think you'd see improvements in all of those.
Yeah. Because actually, whenever you're saying that, I mean, you just mentioned there self-efficacy, thinking about the word just confidence. You know, I want to build a bit more confidence in my team. And again, you know, that we come back to coaching is the answer. You know,
in case I don't get to squeeze this in, because it came to me when you were asking me right at the very beginning of this about, you know, where I suddenly got confidence as a young child. And of course, I don't think this individual was a coach. I don't know. I was only like 16 years old. But I had one guy in my life, a teacher, who basically, he put me out of my comfort zone. So, you know, we talked about me then looking for challenges. Well, that started with somebody putting me out of my comfort zone. And so when I look back now, I would, you know, I'd almost say those conversations I had with him were coaching conversations, and he gave me the confidence to then take a bit of risk. So, you know, that would be another thing, I think, which is huge.
Yeah, because in many ways, I know in my experience as a coach, you know, part of my role is to stretch the other person's thinking, you know, in a professional way, but where you put two things together, you put high challenge or high stretch, but coupled with high support. So in that, you know, psychologically safe environment, in that conversation, which is confidential, you know, between two people, you can stretch the other person, you know, where you've got a good level of trust, you can stretch the other individual, move them forward, and help in many ways build their confidence. And that maybe comes back to the your comment about, you know, sustainable coaching, you know, where ultimately then that person will want to come back for more of those conversations. Because in fact, going right back to your first comments, you know, there'll be a learning part of the experience. They will implement something as a result of the coaching conversation, and there'll be improvement, and they'll come back for more. So you get that cyclical approach in many ways, where a school leader or leadership team has been able to bring in coaching into their school, but coaching done well, which I think is going to be, you know, a real encouragement for folks who are listening. Chris, as a wrap up to our conversation, I'd love to hear your thoughts on, now this is a big question, what's next in coaching and education? Just basically, have you any thoughts or ideas about, you know, the direction of travel for coaching and education over the next few years?
I'm more excited than I am concerned, but I do have some concerns. So I think we've kind of, and of course, coaching's not new, but is relatively new to education. So we've embraced this kind of incredible PD tool. But it now feels like we've got the tool, and now it's up to kind of the tradesperson, I suppose, to make sure that they use it effectively. And like anything, there's a danger that that's not happening. I mean, I think if we've got a mutual friend, kind of Ian Henderson, who works at Wellington and kind of runs the Festival of Education. We were chatting recently about how potentially, you know, if we're not careful, we're gonna run out of time to save coaching, he would say, you know, in education, if we don't get some clarity. And to link it back to that idea of baggage, you know, I think potentially we are unwittingly, you know, creating some baggage for some people that, you know, we need to be careful about. And so my worry, before we get onto the positive stuff, is that, the capacity and training stuff is an issue. And maybe our fixed mindset of either coaching as an activity and not an approach, but also maybe a fixed mindset of one way of doing it is probably not particularly helpful. But anyway, on positive thing, I think I'm super excited about things. I've been doing quite a bit of team coaching. I think that is fascinating and potentially one way to get around the capacity issues in schools. It has its weaknesses in terms of, you know, psychological safety and stuff, but there's definitely a capacity issue. But also I find when I'm doing team coaching that there's an increased appreciation of the kind of interdependence of things, because, you know, suddenly you're exposed to other people's thinking and other people's roles and other people's ways of doing things. So I think there's something there. Back on the kind of capacity and funding thing, just so people heard it here, if it ever becomes anything, this idea of almost like a reciprocal coaching network. Do you know, like, I sometimes think that, you know, I would quite willingly give up my time as a coach to then receive some coaching. And so I wonder whether there's something in that around building kind of networks of coaches that, you know, work on a kind of reciprocal nature, which I think is fascinating. And of course, if that coaching was done across organizations, that might increase psychological safety as well. You know, people not even know who you are. I think you can't avoid the, you know, the technology element. I think that's going to become, you know, increasingly important. And I think that for me, I'm not worried about that or scared about it. I think as long as the technology doesn't do the thinking or the decision making for the coachee, then I think there's some value in that, you know, certainly in terms of awareness. That's interesting. And then I was playing around with the other day, this idea of, in my organization, we've got this. Okay. So we've got the coaching culture, we've got the coaching approach, and we've got formal coaching. What is it where it's more formal than a corridor conversation, but it's not an extended coaching relationship? So I wonder whether there's a fourth dimension to my little model. And, you know, maybe if anybody in the comments can think of a catchy name for that, I'd appreciate it.
Always looking for new ideas, Chris. I like that. I think that's important. But, you know, you said two things which I think are very helpful. First of all, there will always be concerns. And I think, you know, we wouldn't be doing our job properly if we didn't keep an eye out for concerns and make sure, again, you know, that we're very much around coaching done well. But at the same time, we need to be enthusiastic. We need to be creative. We need to be thinking about, you know, new ideas, embracing new technology. And even things like you mentioned team coaching, and know certainly at Growth Coaching International, there's been a fair bit of work into the whole area of team coaching. I interviewed our own Gray Ryan a number of episodes ago, and he touched on team coaching. So there are a number of other things out there that, yes, you know, certainly schools have other options that they can look at down the line. Once they've got, you know, a coaching culture, you know, established, and they're starting to embed that, definitely other options for them. Chris, this has certainly been a really insightful conversation today, and I do genuinely want to thank you for sharing, well, firstly, your personal story with us. I do appreciate that, and so will our listeners, but also your insights on leadership, coaching, and professional learning. You have provided our listeners with plenty to think about. We want to wish you continued success on your obsession with professional learning. To use your words, no doubt it will continue to benefit many educators out there. For our listeners, if today's conversation resonated with you, be sure to take some time to check out lots of free coaching resources on our website and information about upcoming training opportunities and events. And as always, I look forward to joining you all on the next episode of Coaching in Education, where theory and good intentions meet reality.